Thank you very much, and I also like to thank the organizers for letting me present this topic here. If you are checking the booklets of the with the abstracts, I'm not employed at the University of Novi Sad, but you know, who knows what the future might bring. Anyway, here I'm going to present the phenomenon of popular music as a transnational and extraterritorial propaganda and ideologization tool in a new light, namely as a medium for levering nationalisms, both on the domestic and foreign terrain, and also try thus to showcase the interrelated nature of foreign and internal policies in the Cold War period on the example of Yugoslavia in the very turbulent decades for this country in the 60s and 70s. And this topic can also present from a rather new perspective this paradigm-shifting situation, which I'm going to describe, of having workers, a large number of workers from a socialist country, living and pursuing their lifestyle, political activity included, on the capitalist soil. So, first of all, a little bit of historical introduction. In the late 60s and early 70s, there was a huge influx of workforce from Yugoslavia to the Western countries, especially to Federal Republic of Germany. The yearly rate of this immigration reached astounding 230,000 people a year. So in 1971, there were already over 800,000 people officially registered Yugoslavs working in the West. Unofficially, this number went well over 1 million, so it represented almost one-fifth of the overall working populace of the country. At first, Yugoslav authorities were quite oblivious of this phenomenon, and on the lower party echelons, they were even hostile to it on ideological grounds, because it was they were apparently outraged that workers from a socialist country would voluntarily go and contribute to the capitalist economic miracle of the years. However, in the late 1960s, the authorities had to accept this migration wave as a given and to undertake certain measures to control it, mainly for two reasons. Firstly, the migration wave relieved Yugoslav economy of the unemployment burden and also brought hard currency remittances, and these remittances became a very important factor of the Yugoslav economy. Even up to date, in post-Yugoslav countries, they are very important. Secondly, in the 60s and 70s, there were already around 200,000 political emigrants from Yugoslavia living in the West who left after the Second World War for various reasons. And as you can imagine, they were mostly vehemently anti-communist and nationalist oriented. So these new wave of migrants, the economic migrants now were supposed to be somehow sheltered away from the negative influence of political emigres. So those were the reasons why Yugoslav government founded special bodies dealing with economic immigrant affairs. You can read this institutional mechanism here. The most important was the Coordinating Committee for Cultural Entertainment Activities, with this very long name of the institution. Then also Republic's Matica institutions, diplomatic organs, and the cultural informational centers founded somewhat later. And then this first institution, the committee, is the most important. And exactly these cultural entertainment activities, which are the main topic of my speech today, quite paradoxically, they became one of the prime activities of all these bodies for very important reasons. In this sphere, contact between economic and political emigrants was the most probable, since many emigres, political emigres, used private managers and taverns to sort of recruit fresh blood among the guest workers. Also, culture and leisure activities were important for keeping workers' identity, Yugoslav identity and socialist identity while abroad. Also hoping to eventually facilitate the return migration cycle, which, by the way, never really happened. It remained more or less pie in the sky. And last but not the least, the Yugoslav state could cash in very large amounts of money through organizing these activities. And I have to emphasize, these efforts should not be confused with the cultural diplomacy, which is something else, since native audiences, so the Westerners themselves, were quite secondary to these efforts, although, as you will see, this will gradually evolve as well. Now, when I say cultural entertainment activities, in the 1960s at least, that meant big music tours organized by national radio stations. So these four radio stations, Zagreb, Belgrade, Sarajevo, and Skopje, had special programs broadcast to Yugoslavs living abroad. So in the late 60s, they made concept tour shows based on these programs, which then went on and toured for a couple of months, a couple of weeks around Western Europe. So these tours had very large orchestras, and they had very large dance ensembles as well. Up to 80 people were involved all together. And also they would, for the singing part, they would invite the most famous singers from Yugoslavia in a federally structured way. So what it meant, as you could hear, Yugoslavia had six republics. So one singer would be invited from each of the republic to represent the respective constituents' culture. In 1973, also two provinces were added, Kosovo and Vojvodina, since the next following year they got much larger autonomy by the new constitution. Due to this very large number of professionals involved, these tours were very expensive, and thus they could tour only twice a year, and they could visit only the biggest cities in the West. Apart from the state itself, big economic enterprises from Yugoslavia took part in financing and sponsoring these events in exchange for being promoted at the concerts. And also big Yugoslav banks were very generous sponsor of the concerts. And this practice, however, caused dissatisfaction and complaints both from some guest workers associations as well as from some politicians involved in these institutions. They were accused of commercializing these activities on behalf of the state. So arguably the state itself was extorting heavily earned Deutschmarks and francs from workers, and for apparent reasons this was outrageous for a socialist country. Also due to heavy costs, as I mentioned, most Yugoslavs who lived in smaller towns in the West, they could never see these shows because they just visited Vienna, Munich, Paris, Stockholm, etc., not these smaller communities. And this initiated big discussions within the respective coordinating committees. So consequently, in the early 1970s, big changes were made to the cultural entertainment activities. Big radio station tours more or less remain in the same format, yet there was a new priority now to sort of make a competition in a way of smaller ensembles with similarly all Yugoslav repertoire to be sent from Yugoslavia. This measure, however, caused bickering among ensembles for financial support of Yugoslav state, and the republics were always using arguments of ethnic and federal reciprocity to achieve better conditions and longer tours for their artists. So, for example, if Slovenia got that many slots for singing their ensembles, Kosovo had to get as much. Or if Radio Zagreb tour lasted for 25 days, Radio Belgrade tour could not last only 20 days. And all these sorts of discussions ensued. However, much more far-reaching was another initiative, namely to involve grassroots amateur emigrant ensembles, so formed by guest workers themselves in the West. And this new feature had a very important ideological pretext. It was a prime example of how the Yugoslav system of self-management could function also on a capitalist soil in the sphere of culture. And thus we can see how these music tours were used to sort of transnationally transplant the self-management, or at least create an image of such transplantation taking place. Also, this image, I have to say, was fostered as much as an asset of foreign as of domestic policy. By an unwritten rule, these amateur grassroots ensembles were always without ethnic prefix. They were pan-Yugoslav, although I found some cases of existing Macedonian or Slovene, so mononational ensembles. However, never Serbian or Croatian ones. And that's another proof that these sort of big nationalism of Serbs and Croats were apparently much more dangerous to the cohesion of the whole country than these smaller ones, especially since some of these nationalities, such as Macedonians, they were for the first time actually recognized by the communists themselves. In connection to this, the problem of nationalism and how to channel and contain it through music was tackled within the state organs, and they took it very seriously, actually much more seriously than the aforementioned issue of commercialization. When the institutions had these discussions about how to decrease the cost of radio tours, there were some suggestions that, you know, not six or eight singers should be invited. Maybe just we invite two or three of them so one can represent several republics. But then there were very serious arguments claiming that a Croatian could not possibly sing a Macedonian song. How is it even possible? Or there was always a question about the representative of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Should only Muslim singers represent Bosnia because Serbs and Croats already have their own representatives, yet Serbian or Croatian singers from Bosnia would be then discriminated. So all these sort of discussions were taking place. Conspicuously, brotherhood and unity concept, understood as equality of constituent nations of Yugoslavia, led increasingly into an essentialization of republic's borders, transforming them into a sort of holistic cultural entities. The content of all these shows was very carefully inspected and analyzed by political circles through various means. There was, I found, reports by ensembles, audience, spies, even consuls. Also, foreign press in the West was monitored for reviews of these shows. And if repertoire was deviating in any way from the pan-Yugoslav character, ensembles would be warned and ultimately ostracized from the state support. Yet, in reality, there were different thresholds of ideological tolerance. So, for example, there was a case, allegedly, that when Radio Belgrade organized tours, Serbian representatives could not sing certain songs, mostly those which mentioned Serbs or Serbia in the lyrics. Yet when Radio Zagreb organized their own tours, Serbian singers could sing whatever they wished. They didn't have these sort of restrictions. Also, there are some a posteriori testimonies which state that it was not uncommon for some singers when on these state-sponsored tours, and when they would have a night off, they would actually visit these clubs owned by political immigrants, Ustasha, Chetnik, or whichever, and they would actually perform there for money and sing appropriately nationalist repertoire. This was especially common in North America and Australia, and I would say probably because Yugoslav secret services, that could be one of the reasons, had a far less diffuse network than in Western Europe, so the singers could do it with less danger of being caught. However, such affiliations caused conflicts among performers themselves, and it could not be excluded that some of them probably even reported to the state security about this, about activities of the problematic individuals. In 1973, in the domestic press, there was a virtual witch hunt by the members of the Estrada Association against every alleged deviation from the patriotic and all Yugoslav behavior. And here are a couple of these problematic individuals. I'll just name a couple of examples. So the gentleman on the top is very talented and very famous Croatian singer Vice Vukov, who in late 60s became practically lynched by the Yugoslav media because of his alleged great Croatian nationalism. He was not only ousted from these tours, he had to leave Yugoslavia. He lived for decades in Yugoslavia, outside of Yugoslavia. He tried in the end to make up with the authorities. It didn't work out, so he returned only as a politician, actually, when Croatia became independent. The gentleman on the middle left, Predrag Živković Tozovac, actually this very photo caused a problem for him. Not because of the sexual tension between him and the canon, but because this was a poster where he promoted his concerts as concerts of the king of Serbian music. So the allusions to the king and to the Serbian music were sort of earned him a reprimand from authorities. Predrag Cune Gojković, he lived actually for a couple of years in the US. When he returned to the country in 1971, it took him actually several years that he regained his popularity and that he was allowed again to sing in these tours. Although he had already been quite famous before he left for America, he was often interrogated by state security because he allegedly sang at political emigre clubs. In the lower left, you also have the Bajić brothers, who are some sort of, let's say, parody folk duo. They were a couple of times even imprisoned because of their dubious repertoire and dubious behavior when on tours abroad, and they actually did it quite explicitly. I'll come back to the lady a little bit later. In this very same period, so talking about the turn of the decade, 60s to 70s, the genre character of the tours changed as well, or at least was modified to an extent. As already implied, at first these cultural entertainment activities relied mostly on federally structured song and dance tours, especially on folk song and dance. This was at first justified by the fact that most guest workers hailed from countryside and had a fairly low educational level, and that folk music more or less remained a very popular genre, especially in Eastern republics of Yugoslavia. However, in the first half of 1970s, this trend caused some dissatisfaction among cultural ideologists and members of the relevant institutions. They feared, as they said, that constant feeding of guest workers with folklore would make them dumber. Also, relying on rural folk traditions bore a danger of overemphasizing ethnic peculiarities of certain nations. Potentially leading to nationalist excesses, as shown in some of the aforementioned scandals. On the other hand, it was also a bad promotion of Yugoslav culture to the Westerners, who, I quote, would be bored seeing us playing lutes all the time. There were some cases, for example, which were in these discussions always, they gained a prominent place. For example, when symphonic orchestras of Belgrade and Zagreb combined when they had a tour abroad. So their concerts combined could not attract as much audience as the aforementioned singer Silvana Armenulic. There was also a big scandal on a concert in Vienna when a couple of Yugoslav opera singers were also invited to be part of those guest worker tours. They were booed off stage because the audience wanted actually more of folk music as an encore. Some voices in the coordinating committee started now strictly distinguishing cultural from entertainment activities, eventually even juxtaposing them against one another. So in the mid-1970s, the highest echelon of power in Yugoslavia, the presidency of Yugoslavia, called for a more modernizing and cultivating cultural policy for emigrants to be inaugurated. It is paradigmatic that exactly around this time, 1972, so-called kitsch tax was introduced, which sort of taxed every cultural product which was considered not to be in line with the cultural policies. And one of the victims of this was also one of Silvana's song, Jugo Moja Jugo. This song was actually written, the lyrics were written by a female guest worker from Germany. And this song described the life of guest workers from Yugoslavia, but this song was actually banned from Radio Sarajevo tour because of its kitschy content and pathetic form. Now, as a result of all these measures, concert tours of folk ensembles and singers in the West had to be proportionally supported with other types of culture, be it pop or rock bands, classical music, art exhibitions, theater plays, even ballet performances. Yet the organizers, even in the ensuing years, still admitted that some compromises with bad taste of audiences, as they called it, still had to be made. For example, folk songs inserted in between theater acts or ballet mixed somehow with pop music, folk music, etc. To slowly sum up, the ambivalent attitude of socialist authorities towards folk music from all this can be discerned. On the one hand, folk culture helped promoting the multicultural legacy of diverse ethnic traditions of Yugoslavia. On the other hand, it was also it could be considered as a remnant of bygone eras. It could potentially lead to ethnocentrism. Particularly revealing was this essentialization of republics' cultures. And here, I would say, lies the crucial paradox of Yugoslav society in general. Exactly this difficulty to find the equilibrium between the overt Yugoslav centralism on the one hand and excessive particularism of republics on the other. Moreover, many measures which initially aimed to curb nationalist sentiments in various spheres of social reality, they ended up actually feeding exactly the phenomena that they were supposed to contain due to the increasingly centripetal character of the entire system. And I guess that can lean on to the discussion we just had a couple of minutes ago. Also, culture and entertainment were now seen as two opposites, and culture had the aim as sort of, you know, preferred of these two. It had the aim to advance the workers up the social ladder and to bring them further to the alleged socialist ideals of emancipated working class. Another peculiarity of these efforts to cultivate the content of cultural entertainment activities was that they were assigned this transnational cultural propaganda for emigrants only slowly started getting features of a cultural diplomacy targeting native Westerners as well. So these activities were not only migrant-oriented policy anymore, but a cultural export of a sort, building a Western image of Yugoslavia, and thus had to be appropriately conceived and performed. And in the end, just one more aspect that can be seen from this case study, and that's the ambivalent attitude of Yugoslav institutions, which on the one hand wish to earn as much hard currency as possible through these activities, of course, simultaneously increasing political and social control over progressive migrants. On the other hand, Yugoslav authorities also try to present this money-making practice in a socialist packaging, both to emigrants and the West alike. And I guess that's another paradox of a country which tried to combine financial pragmatism with the ideological purity. Thank you very much.